'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
In my mind,
and different.
Sleep in heaven.
Go watch that.
to remember this land.
Temptations.
This is Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time. The George Warner Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
All right, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show, folks. It's on the air, and it is cold as hell in the city of Chicago, and it's just going to get colder. I mean, it's cold. If you're out there... Okay, all right. If you're out there, get out of that stuff. It's going to get... It just gets worse from, I don't want to say from day to day, maybe hour to hour. It gets worse in the city of Chicago and around most of the country, most of America, from what I'm told by listening to weather reports. But with or without the weather reports, I have to get out there too. And I and it's freezing. And you know, you don't want to freeze your ass off out there. So what you want to do, you want to make sure you're bundled up if you have to be out there. Sometimes when I'm out there in this frigid, cold, unpredictable and unseasonable weather for December. And if you look at the calendar, folks, like I was saying yesterday, it's still fall. It's not winter yet. Winter will not come until next week, either Tuesday or Thursday of next week. And it's blasting cold. It's Arctic cold. It's dangerously cold. So if you have to be out there, get out there and do what you got to do and get back home. If you don't have to go outside, don't go. Do not venture out, especially if you're a senior, you're elderly. You know, you don't have to be out there. Don't go. A lot of people are running to the supermarket, to the stores to to pack up on foods. That's great as long as you get there and get back. Because, you know, I mean, if you walk into the corner and back, I mean, you could freeze your ass off. Just walk into the corner and back. And I'm not being facetious. I'm not being sarcastic or anything. I'm telling you the truth. It's cold out there, especially in the city of Chicago and the surrounding states. And just about everywhere there is within America. So it's rough, folks. So get out of the cold and... one more time, if you have to be out there, bundle up. I see so many people out there, even when I was out there earlier today, undressed. They don't wear caps or they don't have anything on their heads. They think they're cute. They think they're fine. They don't want to hide their looks, all to freeze their asses off, you know. And it's ironic also that some people actually have hoods and scarves on, but they will not put them on their head. You know, I mean, if you want to freeze your ass off, you go right ahead. Just don't come around me when you start coughing and having symptoms of the flu or some other illness because you decided that you were too pretty to cover up out here in this Arctic cold. And this is no joke. I mean, I wrote a book about, and I added some of this in that book. It's called The Deep Freeze. You can always find it on Amazon.com. Just put my name up there in the address bar and you'll find that book, The Deep Freeze. It's pretty good. It's a pretty decent book. It's a lot of action. It's fiction. All right. Welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. You can always contact me on Facebook. Contact me right here on Blog Talk Radio. Follow me right here on Blog Talk Radio. Follow me on Amazon. Follow me all over the place. I'm on Google. I'm on everywhere. I'm not that hard to find. Especially if you want to talk about substance, if you have something you want to say, that's no problem with me. 347-857-1762. You can call in and talk about the weather or talk about anything you want to call talk about, or just sit back and relax. A lot of people just like sitting back and relaxing, and I've noticed that. That's fine. It's cold. It's cold. If you're going to listen to anything on this Arctic day, on these Arctic days, maybe I should say weeks, because this has been going on for quite a while. And they say it's only can get worse. Anyway, if you're going to listen to something, you know, listen to the George Wilder Jr. Show. Okay. I have lots of podcasts on this website, Block Talk Radio, and listen to any of them. They're all great, even if I'm doing it. And make sure you check me out. Check out my books and stories, Hit Me and You Die, on Amazon.com. Check out everything that I have ever written on Amazon.com. You will not regret it. I've gotten some feedback, people telling me that some of the prices on the books and the stories are too high. Well, you know, I mean, it's up to you. You can either buy it, or you can just, if you have Kindle Unlimited, you can read it for free. You don't have to spend a cent. You can always read a sample of it. And a lot of times I give my books away and my stories away for a certain amount of time just to promote them. Yeah, a lot of the stories up there that I've gotten prices on, sometimes you put prices on, it's a business decision. You put a price on a book, you may put a higher price on the book than what you may think it's worth. High prices are made to come down, okay? For instance, once I publish a book, and I usually publish them myself, I publish them and I put the price on them. I choose the price. No one chooses the price for a book. For anything that I write, I choose the price of what I want to charge for this particular book. And if some people say, well, George, that's too high for you, only have about 50, 60 pages. That's too high. You know, usually when something comes out for the first time and recently published, it's going to be higher than it probably should be. I mean, that goes for any product. Later on, the price will drop. And I can say the same thing for my books and stories. The prices will drop. You know, but once I've published them, it's going to be, you know, and as a writer, you feel writing is not easy. It's tough. It's hard. I mean, you have to really create just about everything that you put down on paper. So, a writer may price his book or his story or whatever on just the idea of how hard it was to pen it, to write that stuff down, to publish it, to edit it, to draft it, I mean, to format it. I mean, all of that plays into the pricing, you know, and for me, it does. So if you're griping about some of the prices on the books and the stories that I have, hold on. A lot of that stuff will be free. So I'm going to promote it and the prices will come down. Not much, but they will come down as the book is downloaded, reviewed, and enjoyed. All right. You've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We've been talking about the deep freeze in the city of Chicago. Let me say one more thing. My guest today is author Dorothy Kuhn. She will be Hopefully she will be on the show today if the weather hasn't, had some effect on her, because the weather can have effect. This type of weather can have effect on people. Okay, my guest today, if I can say it, is author Dorothy Kuhn. And we're going to find out what she's going to be talking about as soon as she gets here. Okay, let's go. And I want to say one thing, folks. Happy holidays to everybody out there. Christmas is in just about a week or so away. And it's great to see people out there helping those who cannot help themselves, helping those who are homeless, helping those who do not have a place to stay, do not have food to eat, do not have friends or family. It's great to see people doing that this Christmas season and these holidays that's upon us. It's great to see that. It's wonderful. And it's out there. People are helping people, and that's it. And there's no politics into this. There's no politicians involved in this. It's just people helping people. Although politicians will try to take the credit for it. You know, if they always try to take the credit for people helping people, you know, especially around election time, they want to get votes. They want to they're going to take credit for it. But, you know, they can not take credit for anything. If you have a heart and you giving your money, your time, your effort to help other people, no politician can come along and claim that. You know, you're just going to have to put these assholes in their place. So it's great to see the people helping people during the holidays. And I want to say Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays to everyone out there. You're listening to the Talk of Our Times. And I want to say this to people out there. When things go wrong, that is the time to never quit. You never quit when things go wrong. You never do. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We will be right back. We're going to do a musical break right here. Folks, stay with me. All right, welcome back to the George Wilder Jr. Show. All right, that's enough. Bears and Packers this Sunday. The Bears and the Packers. That should be interesting. The Packers are coming off a big win. The Bears are coming off a big loss. So that's enough of that. Okay, you can start make your bets. Okay. This just came in across my desk. Huge Yahoo attacked. Every time I look around, somebody's always attacking, hacking Yahoo. I have an email account on Yahoo. And now they're telling me to change. This would be the second or third or fourth time I've changed my email because of a Yahoo attack. They're saying that 1 billion users have been affected. Okay, so I'm going to go and change my password on Yahoo. They're saying that your information, all of your information has been compromised. So it's best to change your password. Now, why are they telling us to change our password if these hackers, these thieves, these computer criminals, if they already have our information? That's like saying, telling us to do something after the fact. Well, they have all your information on you. They know all about you. The best thing you can do right now is to change your password. Why change my password if they have everything already? You know, that's I can change it a million times, but they'll still have my information. You know, but, you know, hey, wow, but I'm going to change it, okay? I'm going to change it. That's one of the things that's happening around the world is that during the holidays, you got all of these hackers. They are coming at you. They are coming at you from the computer. They're coming at you in person. I mean, you have to watch, you know, if you're out there shopping and buying things, even if you're online and you're shopping, you're buying things, your information, your personal information is vulnerable to these crooks, whether they're cyber crooks or crooks out here on the streets watching you as you go into a department store and swipe your card. It's just awful. It is, all of us, just awful. All righty, we're going to do this right quick, folks.
Do blacks commit more crimes than other races? The simple answer to this question is yes. The black population of the United States is approximately 13%, and the white population is approximately 62%. These are the FBI crime statistics for 2014, where blacks accounted for 27.8% of the total amount of arrests for that year, an obviously disproportionate amount for a population of 13%. The overall level of arrests for black people is higher than might be expected in almost every category, except for driving under the influence of alcohol. Black people accounted for most of the arrests for murder, 51.3%, robbery, 55.9%, and gambling, 58.9%. They were also significantly above average in several other categories. Weapons crimes, 40.7%, prostitution and commercialized vice, 41.8%, and aggravated assault, 33.1%. A common criticism of these figures is that they are based on arrests by police officers who may be disproportionately targeting black neighborhoods due to racial bias or profiling. However, these statistics seem to be corroborated by the National Crime Victimization Surveys performed by the Department of Justice. The latest NCVS data is from 2008 and is collected by a random survey of 90,000 households. Blacks are consistently disproportionately represented in these surveys, correlating closely with the arrest figures. In addition to this, the number of black police officers has remained steady since 2007 at 12%, while being 13% of the population. There has been a marked rise in non-black ethnic minority officers, but despite police efforts, recruiting blacks into the police force has been challenging due to criminal background checks and a cultural attitude towards the police as an institution. Naturally, murder and non-negligent manslaughter is the category missing from the National Crime Victimization Survey, and it is also the most focused on by the media. Homicides by victim and perpetrator are often presented as percentages as victim and perpetrator by race, which gives a chart that looks like this. Most murders are committed by a perpetrator of the same race as the victim. This obfuscates the severity of the problem by making the number of murders look evenly spread between both racial categories, with a small crossover of black-on-white or white-on-black crime. However, displaying the number of murders brings the issue of disproportionate violence committed by black people into focus. When someone says, "Black lives don't matter" to "Black lives matter," this is what they mean. Black men are responsible for murdering other black men at a rate that is near parity with the murders of white men by other white men, when white men are 5 times as numerous as black men. These murders are usually committed with a handgun. So the question becomes, why? As Aristotle said in Politics, poverty is the parent of revolution and crime. There are many studies that positively correlate poverty with non-violent and violent crime, but I've chosen to use the Edinburgh Study of Youth Transitions and Crime performed by researchers from the University of Edinburgh. I've used this study because the black population of Edinburgh is approximately 1%, and the United Kingdom is a modern, industrialized, English-speaking, Christian heritage, first world democracy. This study has been done predominantly on white British people, and I want to showcase this to demonstrate that poverty has a distinct effect on people regardless of any inherent biological differences, and to remove the possibility that these results are due to racial discrimination. The Edinburgh study followed the lives of around 4,000 young people as they made the transition from childhood to adulthood, using both self-reported data from the young people themselves and linked data from a range of official sources. The researchers studied the effect of childhood poverty on violence in the teenage years, and examined its impact beyond into early adulthood. The researchers have set out four measures of poverty: socioeconomic status of the head of the household, whether the young person was not in education, training, or employment at age 18, whether the young person has been unemployed for more than a year at age 22, neighborhood deprivation based on census measures of poverty in the young person's area of residence. The study found that poverty had a significant and direct effect on young people's likelihood to engage in violence at age 15, even after controlling for the effects of a range of other factors known to influence violent behavior, even when taking into account of a raft of risk indicators that would be expected to increase the propensity to engage in violence, including poor family functioning, the lack of attachment to school, substance misuse, and impulsivity, and a range of protective factors that are known to act as preventatives, such as a strong and positive relationship with the parents. Young people who were living in a family where the head of the household was unemployed or in low-status manual employment, and those who were growing up in communities with high levels of deprivation, were significantly more likely to engage in violence. Household poverty appears to act as an exacerbating factor and increases the chance of such young people offending. The Edinburgh study provides evidence that children living in poverty are overrepresented among violent offenders. Even taking account of this increased risk of offending, however, children from poor backgrounds are disproportionately selected into the juvenile justice system and retained there by decision-making that is based on, amongst other things, their impoverished status. Previous work has shown that this type of systemic processing labels and marginalizes the most vulnerable young people in society, making it difficult for them to move on from offending as they mature. The system causes structural failures that prevent those in poverty from moving out of this condition, and in the longer term, this constrains opportunities and reduces life chances. As Aristotle recognized more than 2,000 years ago, poverty breeds criminal behavior. The Edinburgh study came to an interesting conclusion as to why this behavior would involve violence. For most young people from the most impoverished backgrounds, violence provides a touchstone against which identities are honed. More particularly, violence empowers and is a means of attaining and sustaining status among peers. Willingness to use violence, therefore, becomes a resource for the most dispossessed, and this becomes a persistent feature throughout the teenage years. It follows that poverty will create increased levels of nonviolent crime, such as theft, burglary, or drug dealing. But in the absence of available wealth as a status symbol, impoverished young people use capacity for violence instead. According to Pew Research Center data from 2013, black children are 27.3% of the black population, but 38.4% of those living in poverty. US Census Bureau data from 2014 shows that while overall 18% of families in the US with children under 18 live in poverty, this number rises to 32.1% for black families. The poverty rate for black families with intact marriages drops to 10.8%, but rises dramatically in cases of unmarried single parents. 31.2% of single fathers with children under 18 are impoverished, as are 46.1% of single mothers with children under 18. These figures follow the trend of economic hardship for single parents throughout the rest of the United States, albeit slightly more exaggerated. This has resulted in the black children living in poverty outnumbering white children living in poverty, in spite of white children outnumbering black children by 3-1. US Census Bureau data shows that over half of black children do not live with their biological fathers. Unmarried black mothers with children under 18 are the most impoverished demographic in American society, and they are the most common type of family structure in black communities. A 2005 study from the University of California called The Effects of Poverty and Economic Hardship Across the Generations found that economic pressure appears to be the key mechanism linking hardship to a cascade of effects on children's development. The distress caused by poverty seems to predict lower positive, i.e. self-confidence, good school performance, supportive relationship with peers, and higher negative child outcomes, i.e. antisocial behavior, depressed mood, and symptoms of anxiety. In contrast, higher family income and the investment in children's development appear to have beneficial influences on long-term developmental success. Taken together, the family stress model and investment model suggest an intergenerational transmission of poverty and economic hardship. The family stress model of economic hardship proposes that financial difficulty...
Alrighty. Alrighty, welcome back to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Blog Talk Radio. We have someone on the phone. Let's go to the phones. Hey, you're on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Go right ahead.
Hello, George Wilder. This is Dorothy Kuhn.
Hello, Dorothy Kuhn. How's it going?
It's going fine here in North Texas. How is it up there?
Oh, we're freezing. We're freezing our asses off. It's cold.
I bet.
It is very cold. I mean, pardon me?
I said, we'll be with you on Sunday. It's going to get chilly here Sunday.
Oh, yeah. It's dangerously cold. It's like Arctic cold. And you know what? It's not even winter yet. And it's we've been having this weather. It's dangerously cold.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. I hope you're staying safe and warm.
Yeah, I am. I'm just hoping that a lot of other people are doing the same thing. You know, you got people out here and that shouldn't be out there. You know, if you don't have to go out there, don't. You know, it's just a freak of nature, I guess. Okay, tell my audience about you and your book and all of that kind of thing.
Oh, happy to. So I train and speak on leadership and embodied leadership so that people show up in their best selves, and before you say a word, people really get who you are at a deep level, and you can build that trust before you even speak. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do, and one I had to, because when I was in my 30s, I had none of that, George, and I just could not persuade, you know, a carpenter to buy lumber from me when he needed to build a house. It was crazy.
Okay.
So, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just listening.
Okay, good. I think we have just a little bit of a time delay. I'm getting used to it here. So I have always been very interested in our political conversation. It's a part of leadership in our communities to be able to speak well, to lead well, to be able to connect with people that we disagree with from a political or a community perspective, and yet to be able to come together in a way that forges a new future that is better than what we've got today.
Oh, wow. Sounds interesting.
Yes, so that's a really important point in leadership, and most people will want to explain things, and you know, on the progressive side, we tend that. That's where I'm a center left gal, when we are explaining, we are picking a very weak perspective or frame to come from. It doesn't serve us like we think it should.
Okay, what does the election have to do with this? You've got something down here on your page saying, what can I do after the election? Can you explain that?
Yes, I can. Because with the election results, you know, not everybody in the country mm-hmm. voted, obviously. About a third of the eligible voters did not vote. But of those of us who voted, then, you know, half are pretty happy about the election result and half are pretty mortified, quite frankly.
Why do you think a third of the electorate did not vote?
You know, it is hard for everybody to do the right thing, and we make that much harder when our political discourse is so fractious and our media is so fractured that people can't mm-hmm. tell what's true and what's not. And you see that in the current environment with people who did vote for the president-elect, who are now horrified that they're not going to have their Affordable Care Act insurance anymore. They're not going to have their Obamacare.
Yeah, I agree. But you know what? I didn't vote for Donald Trump. As a lot of us, we voted for Hillary Clinton. And but you know what? I don't really think he's that bad of a guy. I just doesn't think he's smart enough to do the right things, because as a Republican, he's sprouting a lot of Democratic values. And I don't know. He's not in office yet. I don't know. But I actually think a lot of people didn't vote because they didn't want to vote. They were just tired of Obama, and he's just.
Well, I'm sure that there are people who are have that view. You know, we can't characterize, you know, millions of people with one description. That would be asking a little much.
Yeah. So have you written a book?
Not on this, but I train on leadership. I have
Great.
All kinds of material related to leadership, and those are things that I really care a lot about. My observation from the public discourse perspective is that sometimes on the progressive side, we don't necessarily we're not as clear on what kind of presence, how to bring the level of presence that automatically connects with people. You know, when I think about this election and the campaign that led up to it, you know, it's just another example of the triumph of marketing and branding over substance. I mean, we see this from time to time in products that come out. Remember, years ago there was the whole Betamax. It had superior technology for movies in your home and all those kinds of things. They had awful marketing, and they lost in the marketplace.
Okay. All right. What do you think makes a good leader?
A good leader is felt before they even open their mouths. You know, they walk onto the stage. They, you know, people can feel them in the room even before they speak. They move with confidence and really feel very grounded. And it's a feeling that we get deep in our brain stems before it makes it up to that neocortex part of our brains that we go to high school and college for, you know? And so when people get you deeply and they're speaking from a values perspective, and, you know, honestly, the Democrats this year, for the first time in a long, long time, we're really beginning to exercise their values voice from a progressive perspective, deeply rooted in American values.
You have here that I'm a quote here. I used to be invisible and was frustrated, feeling unheard and unseen and powerless. That was you at one time?
Oh, yes. So my background is in science and technology. I graduated from college with a degree in physics and math. I'm a real geek at heart, George. And, you know, I was frustrated in my 30s because I was coming at everything from that very analytical framework. And it doesn't engage people at their, you know, at that fundamental, really core place. Explaining is the weak, the frames. And I had to figure that out. You know, I hadn't studied engineering or computer programming, so I couldn't compete with the hot coders and designers. I had to go into management, so I had to figure out how to lead.
So therefore, you set out on a quest to find the internal leadership leader in yourself.
Yes, and I tell you, George, if a geek like me can figure that out, anybody who wants to can. And I'm on a mission to make that happen.
And I'm with you. I'm right there with you. We're going to make it happen together.
Yes.
Are you thinking about writing a book?
Yes, I have one in work. So it will be out next week.
Can we get a title?
You know, I have a working title, and that really is, you know, it's just a working title, so it'll change.
Okay. All right. I mean, as soon as that book comes out, you let me know and we can highlight it on this show and you can talk about it and you can read an excerpt of it as soon as it comes out, as soon as it's published. You let us know. All right.
Indeed. And people who are interested in more of what it is, like I publish a blog post on mm-hmm. this topic of leadership almost every week. That's always a really great way to stay connected and get the best techniques for stepping into those kinds of leadership roles and habits a step at a time. Would you like to hear some?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Wonderful, wonderful. So there are five keys of really inspiring leaders come from a moral framework. It starts with understanding your moral frame, and there are different moral frames around the world. This comes from a lot of wonderful research that's been done in linguistics and cognitive science. I love those guys. They geek out on what are the big metaphors that are underneath that surface level conversation that we tend to have. Have you ever wondered that?
It crossed my mind a few times.
Yeah, I bet. You know, people will oftentimes, and you see this writ large with our public and political conversations, that conversations
yeah.
will pass either like ships in the night, they won't get one another, or they'll pass and crash, right?
Mm-hmm. Right,
and
right.
So,
right.
So what's behind that? I had been always curious. I was really gratified to become aware in kind of a human way about this research. So I'll just describe it real briefly if you would like.
Okay. Yeah, go right
Wonderful.
Ahead.
It turns out that that all culture and politics have their foundations in a moral framework of some sort, and all moral frameworks have their foundation in a concept of the family. Around the world, there are a handful of family models. For example, in the Far East, culturally, they have a great reverence for elders that we don't share in that same way here in the West, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. here in the West, there are two dominant family models that that really inform and dominate our culture and our politics. One is called a strict father mm-hmm. model. It's hierarchical. It's gendered. You know, there's at the top, there's the father, and then below the mother, and then the children. In this model, the children are born bad, and they have to be mm-hmm. disciplined, like quickly spanked, in order to get them to behave well and to, over time, internalize that level of discipline so that they can grow up to be moral people. And in this model, the evidence that they have internalized discipline and become moral people is that they've done well in the world. And that means that the most well-to-do are the most moral in this family system. Now, from the outside, you can see the logical fallacy of that, right? There are lots of well-to-do people who do highly immoral things.
Author Dorothy Kuhn on the George Wilder Jr. Show. you're great. You're wonderful. Author Dorothy Kuhn on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Can you tell my audience if they wanted to get in touch with you and ask more about what you do and how you do it, how would they get in touch with you? How would they contact you to talk more on this?
The easiest way to get in touch with me is just to pull out your cell phone mm-hmm. and open up your text messaging app. Put in the top
okay.
where you put the numbers in, 44222, and then in the text box, usually that's just right below it, put in the word progressive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, great.
So it's easy, and they will get those five keys to progressive leadership right away. Would you like to hear? I don't know how much time you've got, George. You tell me. But
we got about another minute. Go right ahead.
Okay. You want me to be really brief on that one?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, great. So the other model is called a strong nurtural model. The mom and the dad are roughly co-equal, and they take good care of themselves because wimps cannot raise good children, you know, and so that they can nurture their children, and their children will go out and do good things in the world. It actually turns out to be a more functional family model than the family model you know, a little overstrong on the discipline thing. And it develops quite a bit itself. And it's not hard to see how it is that our political parties line up with each of those family models.
It really is not. So you let us know when that book comes out, and you let us know when it's published, and we will have you back on the show to talk a little bit more about leadership. Okay?
Excellent. I will be happy to do it. Have a wonderful, blessed day.
You too. Happy holidays. Bye-bye.
Happy holidays. Bye for now.
Okay. Author Debbie Kuhn on the George Wilder Jr. Show. We will be right back. We're going to do this, folks. If we got it. Oh.
I'm here today to talk about a disturbing question, which has an equally disturbing answer. My topic is the secrets of domestic violence. And the question I'm going to tackle is the one question everyone always asks. Why does she stay? Why would anyone stay with a man who beats her? I'm not a psychiatrist, a social worker, or an expert in domestic violence. I'm just one woman with a story to tell. I was 22. I had just graduated from Harvard College. I'd moved to New York City for my first job as a writer and editor at 17 Magazine. I had my first apartment, my first little green American Express card, and I had a very big secret. My secret was that I had this gun loaded with hollow point bullets pointed at my head by the man who I thought was my soulmate many, many times. The man who I loved more than anybody on earth held a gun to my head and threatened to kill me more times than I can even remember. I'm here to tell you the story of crazy love, a psychological trap disguised as love, one that millions of women and even a few men fall into every year. It may even be your story. I don't look like a typical domestic violence survivor. I have a BA in English from Harvard College, an MBA in marketing from Wharton Business School. I spent most of my career working for Fortune 500 companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Leo Burnett, and The Washington Post. I've been married for almost 20 years to my second husband, and we have three kids together. My dog is a black lab, and I drive a Honda Odyssey minivan. So my first message for you is that domestic violence happens to everyone. All races, all religions, all income and education levels. It's everywhere. And my second message is that everyone thinks domestic violence happens to women, that it's a women's issue. Not exactly. Over 85% of abusers are men. And domestic abuse happens only in intimate, interdependent, long-term relationships. In other words, in families. The last place we would want or expect to find violence. Which is one reason domestic abuse is so confusing. I would have told you myself that I was the last person on earth who would stay with a man who beats me. But in fact, I was a very typical victim because of my age. I was 22. And in the United States, women ages 16 to 24 are three times as likely to be domestic violence victims as women of other ages. And over 500 women and girls this age are killed every year by abusive partners, boyfriends, and husbands in the United States. I was also a very typical victim because I knew nothing about domestic violence, its warning signs, or its patterns. I met Connor on a cold, rainy January night. He sat next to me on the New York City subway, and he started chatting me up. He told me two things. One was that he, too, had just graduated from an Ivy League school and that he worked at a very impressive Wall Street bank. But what made the biggest impression on me that first meeting was that he was smart and funny, and he looked like a farm boy. He had these big cheeks, these big apple cheeks, and this wheat blonde hair, and he seemed so sweet. One of the smartest things Connor did from the very beginning was to create the illusion that I was the dominant partner in the relationship. He did this, especially at the beginning, by idolizing me. We started dating, and he loved everything about me, that I was smart, that I'd gone to Harvard, that I was passionate about helping teenage girls and my job. He wanted to know everything about my family and my childhood, my hopes and dreams. Connor believed in me as a writer and a woman in a way that no one else ever had. And he also created a magical atmosphere of trust between us by confessing his secret, which was that as a very young boy, starting at age 4, he had been savagely and repeatedly physically abused by his stepfather. And the abuse had gotten so bad that he had had to drop out of school in 8th grade, even though he was very smart. And he'd spent almost 20 years rebuilding his life, which is why that Ivy League degree and the Wall Street job and his bright, shiny future meant so much to him. If you had told me that this smart, funny, sensitive man who adored me would one day dictate whether or not I wore makeup, how short my skirts were, where I lived, what jobs I took, who my friends were, and where I spent Christmas, I would have laughed at you. Because there was not a hint of violence or control or anger in Connor at the beginning. I didn't know that the first stage in any domestic violence relationship is to seduce and charm the victim. I also didn't know that the second step is to isolate the victim. Now, Connor did not come home one day and announce, you know, hey, all this Romeo and Juliet stuff has been great, but I need to move into the next phase where I isolate you and I abuse you. So I need to get you out of this apartment where the neighbors can hear you scream and out of this city where you have friends and family and coworkers who can see the bruises. Instead, Connor came home one Friday evening, and he told me that he had quit his job that day, his dream job. And he said that he had quit his job because of me, because I had made him feel so safe and loved that he didn't need to prove himself on Wall Street anymore. And he just wanted to get out of the city and away from his abusive, dysfunctional family and move to a tiny town in New England where he could start his life over with me by his side. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was leave New York and my dream job. But I thought you made sacrifices for your soulmate. So I agreed, and I quit my job, and Connor and I left Manhattan together. I had no idea I was falling into crazy love, that I was walking headfirst into a carefully laid physical, financial, and psychological trap. The next step in the domestic violence pattern is to introduce the threat of violence and see how she reacts. And here's where those guns come in. As soon as we moved to New England, you know that place where Connor was supposed to feel so safe? He bought 3 guns. He kept one in the glove compartment of our car. He kept one under the pillows on our bed. And the 3rd one he kept in his pocket at all times. And he said that he needed those guns because of the trauma he'd experienced as a young boy. He needed them to feel protected. But those guns were really a message for me. And even though he hadn't raised a hand to me, my life was already in grave danger every minute of every day. Connor first physically attacked me 5 days before our wedding. It was 7 a.m. I still had on my nightgown. I was working on my computer trying to finish a freelance writing assignment, and I got frustrated. And Connor used my anger as an excuse to put both of his hands around my neck and to squeeze so tightly that I could not breathe or scream. And he used the chokehold to hit my head repeatedly against the wall. 5 days later, the 10 bruises on my neck had just faded, and I put on my mother's wedding dress, and I married him. Despite what had happened, I was sure we were going to live happily ever after, because I loved him, and he loved me so much. And he was very, very sorry. He had just been really stressed out by the wedding and by becoming a family with me. It was an isolated incident, and he was never going to hurt me again. It happened twice more on the honeymoon. The first time, I was driving to find a secret beach, and I got lost. And he punched me in the side of my head so hard that the other side of my head repeatedly hit the driver's side window. And then a few days later, driving home from our honeymoon, he got frustrated by traffic, and he threw a cold Big Mac in my face. Connor proceeded to beat me once or twice a week for the next 2.5 years of our marriage. I was mistaken in thinking that I was unique and alone in this situation. 1 in 3 American women experiences domestic violence or stalking at some point in her life. And the CDC reports that 15 million children are abused every year. 15 million. So actually, I was in very good company. Back to my question. Why did I stay? The answer is easy. I didn't know he was abusing me. Even though he held those loaded guns to my head, pushed me downstairs, threatened to kill our dog, pulled the key out of the car ignition as I drove down the highway, poured coffee grinds on my head as I dressed for a job interview. I never once thought of myself as a battered wife. Instead, I was a very strong woman in love with a deeply troubled man, and I was the only person on earth who could help Connor face his demons. The other question everybody asks is, why doesn't she just leave? Why didn't I walk out? I could have left any time. To me, this is the saddest and most painful question that people ask. Because we victims know something you usually don't. It's incredibly dangerous to leave an abuser. Because the final step in the domestic violence pattern is kill her. Over 70% of domestic violence murders happen after the victim has ended the relationship, after she's gotten out, because then the abuser has nothing left to lose. Other outcomes include long-term stalking, even after the abuser remarries, denial of financial resources, and manipulation of the family court system to terrify the victim and her children, who are regularly forced by family court judges to spend unsupervised time with the man who beat their mother. And still we ask, why doesn't she just leave? I was able to leave because of one final sadistic beating that broke through my denial. I realized that the man who I loved so much was going to kill me if I let him. So I broke the silence. I told everyone. The police, my neighbors, my friends and family, total strangers. And I'm here today because you all helped me. We tend to stereotype victims as grisly headlines, self-destructive women, damaged goods. The question, why does she stay, is code for some people for it's her fault for staying, as if victims intentionally choose to fall in love with men intent upon destroying us. But since publishing Crazy Love, I have heard hundreds of stories from men and women who also got out, who learned an invaluable life lesson from what happened, and who rebuilt lives, joyous, happy lives, as employees, wives, and mothers, lives completely free of violence, like me. Because it turns out that I'm actually a very typical domestic violence victim and a typical domestic violence survivor. I remarried a kind and gentle man. We have those three kids. I have that black lab, and I have that minivan. What I will never have again, ever, is a loaded gun held to my head by someone who says that he loves me. Now, right now, maybe you're thinking, wow, this is fascinating. Or, wow, how stupid was she? But this whole time, I've actually been talking about you. I promise you, there are several people listening to me right now who are currently being abused, or who were abused as children, or who are abusers themselves. Abuse could be affecting your daughter, your sister, your best friend right now. I was able to end my own crazy love story by breaking the silence. I'm still breaking the silence today. It's my way of helping other victims. And it's my final request of you. Talk about what you heard here. Abuse thrives only in silence. You have the power to end domestic violence simply by shining a spotlight on it. We victims need everyone. We need every one of you to understand the secrets of domestic violence. Show abuse the light of day by talking about it with your children, your coworkers, your friends and family. Recast survivors as wonderful, lovable people with full futures. Recognize the early signs of violence and conscientiously intervene, de-escalate it, show victims a safe way out. Together, we can make our beds, our dinner tables, and our families the safe and peaceful oases they should be. Thank you.
All right, we have a delay here, folks. I apologize if you can hear that, but my thanks again to author Dorothy. I keep saying Debbie. I don't know. It's Dorothy Kuhn on the George Wilder Jr. Show. She'll be right back. She'll be back, folks, on the show if she once she gets a book. Okay, it is dangerously cold, and it will continue to be cold, at least here in Chicago. I'm pretty sure where you are, because the National Weather Report's saying that half the country, if not three-fourths of the country, is under a cold Arctic blast. So I want to say this again. If you're out there, bundle up. If you don't have to go out there, then do not go out. It is cold, folks. It is cold, and it's unseasonably, in some cases, unrealistically cold. This is going to be probably the coldest month in December for generations, maybe, you know, as starting this early, because I predicted about 4 or 5 months ago that we were going to have a mild winter. Boy, was I wrong, because I'm freezing my ass off, and a lot of other people are too. And it's just sad that a lot of these shelters are going to be closing their doors. Yeah, we got a couple of shelters that's closing their doors, going to be closing its doors on the 23rd, 2 days before Christmas. Out there, and you're going to have people, families out there with nowhere to go from this cold 2 days before Christmas. That's got to be something. And Christmas season is supposed to be a season of giving and caring. How in the hell can you throw thousands of people out in the street because the governor will not get a budget? You know, so it's just politics. They're playing politics and with people's lives. People are going to be dying, and they don't give a damn. They just don't care. 2 days before Christmas, and we got a Scrooge in the governor's office, a couple of Scrooges in the legislature, letting these people freeze to death because they don't give a damn. We got a mayor who's budgeting and earmarking millions of dollars to keep illegal immigrants from being deported in the city of Chicago, to keep the safe haven law in effect in Chicago, to keep these people from being deported so they can get food stamps and apartments and drive cars, and yet they don't give two shits about people, the homeless people, shelters in Chicago, people freezing on the streets, Americans, legal Americans. This is crazy. This is nutty. But this is what's happening in the city of Chicago. I think Mary Rahm Emanuel is just an embarrassment to the city. I think he is. He's concerned more with the dreamers, people who were brought to this country and this city illegally, than he is homeless people losing their shelters and being on the streets 2 days before Christmas. Illegal immigrants are his main, keeping the illegal immigrants in Chicago, keeping them under the Safe Haven Act is his number one priority, instead of the homeless people who will be thrown out in the streets because of the shelters closing, because he's earmarking the money that could go to help this shelter and giving it to illegal immigrants. You know, so this is appalling, because Donald Trump said he was going to throw them all out once he became president of the United States. So they're trying to even Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, he's out there touting the dreamers and touting illegal immigrants and saying that they're going to be safe in the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois. They're not going to be safe if the Donald Trump and his victims and his criminals decide to pull federal money from these programs, because they can do it. They can do it. Instead of these creeps focusing on the citizens of Illinois, the people who are born here, the people who are legal, their main focus is on saving the dreamers, saving the illegal immigrants, sheltering them with taxpayer money. I'm not against illegal. I'm not against illegal immigration. I'm not against families and people here who are here illegally. They can stay where they want to stay. I'm against giving them money. Taxpayers' hard-earned money, when that money could go towards shelter for the people out here freezing in the cold, who were born here, who pay taxes. They may not have good jobs. Some of these folks that are out in the street, they're working part-time jobs. Some of these illegals, they're not working anywhere because they don't have the papers. It just doesn't make sense. It's crazy. This is our politicians. One of the things I want to say to my audience, and I've said this several times, some people may not have heard, I am not a Democrat. I am not a Republican. I am an independent. You know, because I used to be a Democrat. I used to vote Republican. And both of these parties have just pissed me off, and I decided, hey, I'm backing away from both of them. Both parties. I'm becoming an independent. I'm going to be like Bernie Sanders, which is my hero, actually. I think if Bernie Sanders had of won the nomination instead of Hillary Clinton, I believe Bernie Sanders would be our president right now. But the DNC and their shenanigans, you know, stopped that from happening. And they gave us Hillary, even though Hillary had a lot of baggage. And I'm pretty sure some of that baggage filtered into the election and she lost. And I agree with Dorothy. I think that a lot of people did not vote. And the people who did vote, some of those people once voted for Obama. Because during the last day or two of the election, Obama and Hillary, they were going around trying to get African-Americans to become excited about voting. They were going from one radio station to the next in the African-American community. However, that failed. And I believe one of the reasons why it failed is because Obama has disappointed the African-American community. A lot of people on Facebook disagree with me on that. I don't give a damn. They can disagree with everything that I say. I don't care. Obama disappointed the African-American and that African-American who voted for him twice decided that they did not want a third term, which would have been Hillary Clinton. I think the election actually was because of Obama. I think Obama lost this election, you know, because people were out in droves, especially during his first election and his second. I mean, people came out for him. But they didn't come out for him this time. They did not come out for him this time. Even though I'm hearing that he still have a higher approval rating within the African-American community. I don't know how true that is. But if that is true, these people got to get their heads up out of the sand. You know, Donald Trump is going around right now embarrassing Obama by, you know, talking to all these high-tech companies. Saving jobs, keeping jobs here. Obama ain't talking. He hasn't been talking to nobody. Only thing Obama has done for 8 years is give lip service. He talked about a lot of things. You know, he doesn't have a legacy. Obamacare, the American Care Act, is not his legacy. Obamacare is a travesty. It's a joke. It's a joke. I, like so many other people, we wanted single payer. Single payer means that health care would be free, F-R-E-E, free. It is up in Canada and other countries, health care free. You go in with a broken leg, they're not going to ask you what kind of insurance do you have. Let me see your insurance card. They're just going to fix you up. And then after they fix you up, taking care of that broken leg for you, they're going to say, have a nice day. That's single payer. You don't pay a cent. It doesn't matter whether you have pre-existing conditions or not. It doesn't matter if you have Medicaid or Medicare. It doesn't, or United Health Insurance or Blue Cross Blue Shield or State Farm or whatever. It would be free. Of course, there's insurance companies. They're not going to like that. Of course, they're not going to like it. But who cares what they like? They're screwing the people anyway. Every time you look around, your premium's going up, 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 up. And that's another subject to talk about. Everything is going up. It doesn't matter what you use. It's going up. Your mortgage is going up. Your rent's going up. Your food is going up. To buy clothes is going up. Your car insurance is going up. Your car notes are going up. Everything is going through the fucking roof. You're going to pay more for this and get less. Especially if you go to the grocery store. I mean, you buy a box of cereal or something that you've been buying for years. Suddenly you look at that cereal and the box then got smaller, thinner. And the price has gone up. That's what's happening to everything. You get less now, less content, a less product for a higher price. Everything's going up, except for gas. Gas is stable. It fluctuates. It goes up and down, but it stays within a certain margin where people can actually afford it. It hasn't hit the $3 mark. The cheapest thing we got is gas. But everything else going through the fucking roof. You know, it's just, what can you do about it? You said, George, you're talking about it, but what can you do? The only thing that I think we can do about it is to vote for people who have our interest. You got to vote. But I understand that you can't trust a lot of these scoundrels out here, these politicians. They're crooks, you know, because we got a crook in Chicago already. His name is Cochran, Alderman Cochran. He's charged with looting fund meant for kids and seniors. And we have another congressman that's on his way to jail, stealing money, basically stealing money, taking bribes. His name is Willie Cochran. He's of the 20th Ward in Chicago. He also faces charges. He took bribes. On top of looting, stealing money from kids and seniors. He's a politician. I think there's more politicians in Chicago and Illinois that go to jail than any other state in America. Corrupt Chicago politicians. And all of these assholes always look like, I didn't do it. Look as if it wasn't me. And sure as hell, it was you. So I just think we got to get our asses out there and vote. You got to vote. You don't vote, nothing changes. It gets worse. And a lot of people did not vote during the election. That's one of the reasons why we have Donald Trump. But however, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote. She won that hands down. But it wasn't the popular vote that got her over the top. It was the electoral vote that gave it to Donald Trump. And all of these recounts, I would probably say no to a lot of these recounts, because a lot of these recounts, if you're doing recounts, you just might cough up more votes for Donald Trump. I think that's what happened in one of these states. It was a recount, and all it did was just show that there were more votes for Trump. And I would say, hey, wow, you know, let Trump be the president of the United States. Even with this Russian, even the United States have proven that the Russia had meddled in the United States election. And they're wondering what was Russia's motivating for wanting to hack the election. Russia's motivation for wanting to hack the election was simple: to get Donald Trump in office. That's all it was. Donald Trump even looked in the camera a few months ago and said, Russia, if you're listening, we've all seen that video. He told Russia, and Russia was listening, and Russia did hack meddled in the election. Will that null and void Donald Trump's presidency? No. He will still be president. He will still be president. And I don't think Hillary Clinton is going to run in 2020. I think she's done. She's lost twice. She doesn't want to make it a third time. Because I do think if Hillary Clinton actually tried to run for president again, they would bring up her emails. And I think if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency and Donald Trump lost, I would think the Republicans will be looking at to impeach her and obstruct her, just like they obstructed Obama. So there is no doubt that if Hillary Clinton would have won the president, if she would have been president-elect, they will be out to impeach her for her emails and other things, and she would have been obstructed. Now, will Donald Trump lock her up like he said in some of his debates? Lousy debate. I don't think so. I don't think he's going to lock her up. I think that was just a lot of heated rhetoric thrown at his supporters. They loved it. Let Donald Trump be the president of the United States. You know, he won, and in some cases, fair and square. Russia might have, could have, or did interfere with the election. However, I don't think that's going to null and void Donald Trump's presidency. I don't think they're going to throw him out of office. I don't think they're going to impeach him for that. I really don't think that's going to happen. But there's no doubt about it, from all reports, that Russia did interfere with America, with the American election. No doubt about that. Election. They interfered. The United States got to find a way to not to let this happen again. There's going to be hearings on it. I can't wait. I'm going to be right there sitting in front of the television. What the hell? Are you guys going to null and void the election because of this? I think the hearings would be a waste of time. I really do. I think the hearings would be a waste of time. But we need to find out what happened. We need to find out what happened, and we need to find out now.
Ladies and gentlemen, the George Wilder Jr. Show has now arrived.
Heaven help the child who never had a home. Heaven help the girl who walks the streets alone. Heaven help the roses if the bombs begin to fall. Heaven never saw. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns.
Oh,
now lay me down before I go to sleep. In a troubled world, I pray the Lord to keep. Keep hatred from the mighty and the mighty from the small.
Democrats. You've been in that party a long time. Answer me. What did you get? You got a president.
Nothing?
He's worried about his legacy. Well, you want Hillary to get in to protect your legacy. Because Trump said the minute he get in, he's going to reverse the Affordable Care Act. Because that's your signature achievement. To show you how hateful the enemy is, he hates that you achieved what you did achieve. So he said, I'm going to tear it up when I get in. So he don't want his legacy destroyed. Mr. President, let the man do if he get in what he want. Because he's not destroying your legacy. If your legacy is bound up in an Affordable Care Act that only affects a few million people and they're trying to...
Okay. The George Wilder Jr. Show is just about off the air. We got a couple of more minutes into the show, and I want to say thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening to the show. Thanks for downloading and podcasting the show. Thanks for all of your great feedback to the show, even on Facebook. I do appreciate it, and I hope you guys join me tomorrow. We're just about off the air, and I want to say bye-bye, everybody. Make sure you tune into the George Wilder Jr. Show. I'm on 4 days. To 7:30, sometimes 8, depends on how well the show is going. But I'm here and I'm here to stay. So you guys join me tomorrow. Bye bye, everybody. I've had a great time. It has been a blast. It has been a blast. Sorry about that.